Hello, and welcome to another episode of Shipping and Handling. I am your host, Jennifer Edden.
And I'm your co-host, Bridget Smith.
How's it going, Bridget? It's been so long.
It's going pretty good. It's been a long time. How you been, Jen?
Shame. Not like we haven't seen each other.
I know.
You came to my birthday party. Yes. I turned 30. I'm officially 30 now, guys. What?
But you were also away at Sirens Conference.
I was, and it was amazing. Sirens, for those of you who don't know, is a conference that focuses on women in fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to this, or Bridget and I went the first...
Several years ago.
2012, 4 years ago, when, you know, during my first year that I went, and we ran a panel, and that was where the whole Portal Fantasy thing started. But this year, there was a really great turnout, and there were some fabulous guests. It was nice. Ray Carson, who wrote... Girl of Fire and Thorns. I was like, Daughter of Smoke and Bone, Girl of Fire and Thorns.
No.
It was Ray Carson.
Also, Walk on Earth, a Stranger, which is her new one.
Yes. Oh my God, I bought it, and I read the first... I bought it at the conference, and I was like, I'm going to get... Because I moderated a panel that she and the other guest, Kate Elliott, who is... an amazingly amazing, prolific writer of
general
books.
Badass.
I love her, and I feel like we're bros now, so I'm hoping that I can keep that going. And Yoon Ha Lee, who's actually one of our clients, and I'm very excited about their new book. But yeah, Walk Under to a Stranger, I bought it before the panel, because I was like, oh, I'm going to get Ray to sign it. And I was waiting for the panel to start, and I read the first, like, 40 pages, and I was like, oh, shit, I'm going to be late for the panel, because I've got to...
At least you've got a very good excuse.
So. Oh, it's so good.
It's like, I'm sorry I'm late for your panel. I was caught up in your book.
Yeah. Walk on Earth, a Stranger is about a girl in the California gold rush who has the power to sense gold. So she can find it in the earth, and, of course, various people want to control this power.
She is more valuable than the gold itself.
And the first chapter is really evocative and, you know, really sets up that this power is sort of really only helpful to a certain point. Because she can sort of be like, well, I can tell that there's gold like a million miles underneath me, but since I'm not a miner and no one in my family is miners, it's not very helpful to me, is it? Thanks, power. But, so she wrote that and, what was I talking about? So yeah, it's just a great conference. It's usually really small. It's almost all women.
Very intimate.
There's always like two dudes there and I'm like, bless. Bless your hearts. Uh-oh. But yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I enjoyed it when I was there.
But yeah, so the panel that I moderated at the behest of Simon Smith, who is a wonderful blogger that you should all be following, was on the iconoclastic revolutionary and just thinking of the idea, talking about the idea of what a strong female character is and what a revolutionary is and our sort of narrow ideas of sort of female strength in books. So we're going to talk about that today.
It seems like
cool.
A good topic. It's very much up both of our alleys.
So. Yes.
So what happened on the panel? What were some of the pertinent questions or thoughts people had?
Oh, God, questions. I mean, one of the great things
you
about
moderated
it,
this panel. What questions did you ask,
oh,
Jen?
Oh, Lord. The nice thing, I was just moderating, and Simon actually set it all up, so most of the questions I sort of had, you know, pre-done for me. But we talked a lot about, you know, the things that we think of, you know, when you say strong female character, before the panel even started, I put up that Kate Beaton comic.
Oh, yes.
With this sort of women in bikinis with guns, you know, I eat my feelings because my dad hates me or something like that.
Yeah. So,
but we talked about, you know, the various sort of stereotypes of a strong female character and how they've kind of evolved and how it used, you know, you didn't used to see the sort of Xena character.
Yeah.
But now you only see the Xena character. Yeah. And most everybody on the panel was sort of hoping that we could find places for more nuance in the definition of, you know, strength.
Strong. Yeah. I think it's one of the pertinent things that I saw a while back, which really summarized my feelings on it, is that strong is meant to modify character, not female. So when you're writing a strong character, that person is not necessarily going to be like the badass. It just means that that person is well-rounded and has an effect on the story and all of that sort of thing. But everyone sort of saw a strong female character and thought, oh, we have to make this person like badass and dangerous and kick-ass.
Yeah.
And that's not really what anyone was asking for, or you want that, but in an array of other types of characters.
Yeah. I think that that is sort of the conclusion that everyone, you know, as much as you can come to a conclusion in 40 minutes of discussion and 10 minutes of Q&A. Because, I mean, I don't think that we should discount how great those characters were, you know, like the Buffys and the Xenas and, you know, that kind of thing. In, you know, changing sort of popular definitions of what women could do on TV.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right. I think that it's really easy to sort of be like, oh, yeah, you know, she punched that car. She's so strong.
This was actually one of the things that I really liked about Fury Road, which...
Yes!
Not like we haven't talked about this movie enough, but it's... Because, well, one of its strengths is that it's got, like, a dozen women
in it. Kate Elliott did, like, 10 minutes on Fury Road in her guest of honor speech. I was just like, you're amazing. She had this whole slideshow that I just want her to, like, give to me. But, yeah, anyway.
But since you have a whole bunch of women in it, you can make them all different. And they can all be different, strong characters in their own rights in different ways, which creates a lot of interest and also doesn't sort of pigeonhole all women into having to be this one type.
Yeah.
That's really the thing, is that when you only have one woman or one female character in a story, anything that you make her makes her representative of all people.
Yeah. I call it the Highlander syndrome.
Yep.
There can only be one. because when you... I think the same applies to minority characters.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, if there's only one person of color in the book, then that one person is like, you know, all the fate of the world, you know, rests on their shoulders or whatever. But yeah, I mean, and one of the things I thought that was the most interesting about the discussion that came up, and this sort of came up in various conversations the whole weekend, actually Amy Boggs moderated a round table on this as well. But the idea of collaboration versus like lone wolfing, you know, collaboration has like both positive and negative connotations, but I think that the sort of lone wolf idea is a very masculine idea. It's a very sort of stereotypically, you can't see my air quotes, but I'm making them, you know, it's the lone wolf. It's the guy like, you know, with his gun. Me against the world. And I think that in a lot of ways, you know, women's narratives about women, and even to a certain extent, like women in the workplace have kind of co-opted that model because of sort of Highlander syndrome.
Yeah.
Whereas for men, it's lone wolf. For women, it's there can only be one.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing.
Yeah. It's any group of characters where you get like the tough one and the funny one and the smart one and the girl.
Yeah.
And so this is something that doesn't just affect stories. It affects the way that we see ourselves in the world. And so if you're in a group of people and you are in that group with a whole bunch of men and one other woman, it might be more beneficial to you to band together and sort of work together. But the way that you see it is that only one of you can succeed. And so you have to compete with this person.
You know, I mean, we've talked about it before where, you know, they think that it's parody when there's actually only 17% women in the room or something. And it just makes me think of that whole... I can't even call it a conversation because I think it was just the whole everyone going, what? What? When Meg Rosoff on Facebook oh my God. Basically saying that, like, you know, people who want to see themselves in books are just being babies.
Which is funny when you're talking about books for actual children.
Actual children.
Like, they are being children. They are children.
I mean, but just the idea that representation, just having people who aren't the dominant narrative be there. Just there. The idea that that is somehow taking something away from someone else is just so mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, ladies, so what would you think would be, so in your sort of like, in your mind, what are some qualities that you would like to see associated with strong female character instead of just punching? and I'm so alone.
Well, I was talking about this a little bit. I have a terrible weakness for female characters who know exactly what they want and are going to get it, even if it destroys them in the process. Like, this is the thing that I have to do, and this is the way that I'm going to do it.
So what are some examples of this kind of character?
Well, Baru Cormorant is one example.
Which I have not read yet, so
I won't spoil anything.
I nearly, at Siren, some people had read it, and I was like,
oh.
I was like, if y'all spoil this fucking book for me, I will cut you. And since I haven't read the next two books in the Raven Boys series,
oh.
I was also like...
No one is allowed to talk about these great books. Baru Cormorant. And then I was actually...
Is it Baru or Baru? Because I've been calling her Baru.
Baru.
Baru. Okay.
And so another one... This is extremely esoteric. I was watching this BBC miniseries from the 80s that Ellen Kushner lent me. It's called Flickers, and it's about the silent movie era. And it's
that
about,
sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's really funny and very interesting. It's got that thing where it's, you know, 80s BBC, and it's visibly cheap, but the actors are fantastic, and the writing is interesting. And so it's got this character who is sort of middle-aged spinster lady, clearly, like, late 30s or 40s, and so...
Middle-aged.
Well...
Middle-aged, Bridget.
You know, in the 20s and 30s...
The life expectancy was not that bad.
No, but when you're unmarried and you're, like, 40 in that
I still
era,
would not call her middle-aged. We can... Okay. Well, I'll give you spinster. I'm not going to give you middle-aged.
Well, she appears middle-aged, but in the very first episode, she gets pregnant. Scandalously.
Surprise!
So,
just like Dorothy L. Sayers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, she needs someone to marry so that this is less of a scandal, and she's not, and the guy who got her pregnant is
a douche.
Exactly. So she's not going to marry him, and so there's this one other option, and who is this, like,
the only man in all the land.
Who is sort of the hero of the show, but he's also a scoundrel, and kind of possibly a con artist, but not charming in the con artist way. He's just kind of like
a flim-flam man.
Yes. And so they decide to, they're going to get married, and they're also going to go into business together and make these TV shows, because her family is wealthy, and or make these movies. Her family is wealthy, but since she got pregnant in a scandalous manner, she's been cut off. And so she's, during this whole episode, as she's figuring out how she's going to solve this problem, she sort of sets her mind, she figures out a solution, she sets her mind to it, and she's going to do it, and no one is going to talk her out of it. And I was like, I really love this character. I love that she is this determined about this thing. And so she's
so determined about this idea that's going to end in sadness.
Everyone, you can tell that everyone who cares about her thinks that it's going to ruin her life. And she sometimes is sort of like, well, this is not what I ever pictured my life being, but it is the option I have chosen, and it's going to solve certain problems that I have. And you know, because it's a BBC miniseries, you can tell it's also going to work out fine for her, but she doesn't know that. And so she's this sort of cold, aristocratic woman, and she's just very determined to do this thing, and I found myself really admiring her for that.
We're rooting for you, girl.
Yeah. I was like, I want you to be happy because you are willing to be unhappy to fix your problem.
Aww.
And so I that is one quality that I really admire in characters, which, and sometimes that manifests itself in punching, but often it doesn't, or it doesn't have to.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about the idea that that one of the ways that we can expand the definition of strong female characters is sort of by incorporating or by placing more sort of central value on sort of like quote unquote traditionally female acts, because one of the things that kept coming up at the conference is the idea of poison as a women's weapon.
Oh, interesting.
And how somehow that was bad, and you know, all the Borgias, you know, the dude Borgias get lauded, and all the lady Borgias are like creepy poisoners, you know, even though the dude Borgias were like also murderers.
Yes.
It's like, let's come on, guys. I don't know, what do you think about that?
Oh, I mean, I've always sort of liked the poison as a woman's weapon thing, mm-hmm. Because it's it's subtle and it's
smarter.
it's clever, and it takes advantage of the skills that you, and knowledge that you have, and also people's expectations of you, I guess. And so I've always sort of liked that. But also, this is what I like about Mary Robinette Kowal's books, is that she has these characters who are strong emotionally and mentally, and who drive the story by doing traditional feminine work in the context of the story. And I'm all for that. I mean, let's elevate women's work while also letting women do other things.
Yes. I mean, yeah, I think that it's just the idea of, you know, you have to be strong and also feminine and, you know, athletic, but you can't be muscular. Like, all there's all these, like, dumb rules that I feel like you sort of run into, even if no one ever comes out and says them to your face.
It's just a subtle reinforcement around you at all times.
Yeah. The patriarchy hurts everybody. But, so who are some of your favorite, you know, female characters that you think are strong, but sort of defy the sort of Katniss model of...
Well, see, this is tough because a lot of them are athletic or, you know, swordswomen because I was a teenage fencer. So the swordswomen were actually reflecting me and the things that I aspired to. And so the physical strength was actually something that I really particularly liked in my characters.
Well, for me, I just finished, I mean, because Rae Carson was one of the, oh, I heard that. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Oh no, the face you're making is so disgruntled right now. I'm sorry. Bridget just hit her funny bone.
Yes.
So because Rae Carson was going to be one of the guests of honor, I finished reading the trilogy, the Girl of Fire and Thorns trilogy. The second one is Crown of Embers, and I think the third one is The Bitter Kingdom. And one of the things that I loved about that book, or I mean, especially Girl of Fire and Thorns, but you know, the whole series, is that the main character like starts out fat and she like loses a little bit of weight, but she's never like lithe and graceful. You know, and I really appreciated that. But also, she's really kind of terrible at everything in the beginning. And not in a way of just like, oh my god, I'm so clumsy, but just in a way of she's been like sheltered and like not told things. And so like her whole journey is like realizing that the people she loves still love her, but also don't have her best interests at heart. And I think that was a really cool thing to read, because I feel like a lot of times it's like, this person loves me, they deceived me for my own good, you know, that kind of thing, which like drives me crazy. Like there's, you know, there's this great part where, spoiler alert, but I feel like the books have been out for a while, so, you know, at one point in one of the last two books, because I read them both on the plane, so they kind of blur together, she realizes that her nurse, who has been sort of like, who was raised to protect her, who, you know, has been, you know, trying to protect her from like day one, has been protecting her by like lying to her and manipulating her.
Oh dear.
And she's like, you know, it's still lying and manipulation if you do it out of love.
Yeah.
And I thought that that was like a really great sort of emotionally healthy thing to see in a YA fantasy heroine, because like so often it's like, well, you know, I just got to deal with it. But she also, you know, she relies on a sort of group of people to help her, and they're all working together in a way that sort of goes back to what I was talking about, like the sort of collaboration idea that, you know, it doesn't have to just be her. Like, yes, she's going to end up being Empress, but she's not going to just do it by like riding roughshod over everyone that's with her.
This is totally something I love, is girls who have each other's backs.
Yes.
Love that. Let me see if I can find some in my...
Your Goodreads.
Yeah. There was also, I was going to say that something I like is how the realization of weakness can actually be a strength, because it's when you're blind to your own weaknesses, you can't defend them.
Right.
And then once you figure them out, you can sort of figure out how to, even if you can't fix that, once you know it's there, you can deal with it. And so that's interesting too, because, you know, everyone is flawed and everyone has these things that they have to make up for and watch out for. Figuring those out is tricky and painful. And so it can be really interesting to watch a character do that.
Like Cher in Clueless.
Yes. Yes.
Love her.
Oh, here's an example of it. The Girls at the Kingfisher Club by Genevieve Valentine.
Have not read it.
Haven't read it.
I gave it to my dad for Christmas.
Oh.
I
think he may have said that.
I feel like. Because he used to always say, don't go dancing. He would put my sister and I to bed.
That's really cute.
He is adorable. He has not read it, though, I don't think. He reads. My parents are at the age where they start reading and then they fall asleep. So they get through my way fewer too. Books than they used to. And I'm just like, how?
But yeah, so that's one where it's there. They don't, you know, it's a group of 12 sisters. Obviously they have problems with each other. They have fights. They have little points of friction that just come up every day that aren't really like breaking points, but they cause pain. Yeah. And so they've got this whole, they have stronger relationships with some sisters than with others, but when it comes down to it, all 12 of them have each other. And the oldest one, who is one of the primary narrators, she is the, or primary point of view characters, because she's the oldest, she takes responsibility for the rest of them. And the way that they sort of deal with this, I found really compelling, and the way that they depend on each other and take care of each other, because obviously their father is useless, slash actively harmful.
Is that an ampersand or is that a
No, it's a G. I always think it's an ampersand. By always, I mean both times that I've purchased it.
All two times.
Two's a pattern, right?
Yeah, and I think that that's why, you know, I feel like a lot of people get sort of tired of, you know, the Mad Max hype.
Mm.
You know, and that kind of thing. And I think it's just because we're so excited to see something it's like that. Like
the first time that that has been that much of a big budget, like, blockbuster type thing. I feel like
George Miller just got away with something.
I know!
I mean, it's like
how did anyone let him make this movie?
I don't know, but it's magical. And bless him so much. And you know, and you think about it, and you think about the movies that Hollywood kind of like sets up to fail, like the terrible action movies starring women that they just set up to fail, or like
it's like we'll make this one movie and then we don't have to for another 5 years.
Yeah, it's like, well, they didn't work. Like so. I feel like people are still saying that, like, because Elektra was terrible,
oh my god,
female like superhero movies aren't gonna work.
All superhero movies made at the time of Elektra were terrible. It was not just Elektra.
It wasn't just her fault. Come on. But yeah, I mean, it's just sometimes it's hard to be a woman.
This is also something that I really liked about Spy.
Oh my god, I love speaking of women having each other's backs.
Yes,
I love that there was not just one but two sort of female relationships in the movie. There's her friend, and then there's her sort of like evil Russian nemesis who's also her friend.
Yes,
I actually like, when does that come out on DVD? Because I'm now reminded of that movie's existence and I want to watch it again.
It's end, like, at the end, she gets the guy, but she's like, actually, no, I'm gonna go hang out with my friend instead, because that is a much more fulfilling relationship.
She
gets
the guy, she realizes the guy is a doofus. Yes. Like, I mean, I love Miranda Hart, so she's, you know, my favorite, but, you know, their whole relationship was so wonderful. I mean, I hope that if they have greenlit a sequel to that, like, yesterday, because it was just funny.
It was just funny. It was really
fun.
Yeah. Oh. Even if I walked out of it going, oh, they swore so much.
Yeah. It's funny. I went to see The Martian over the weekend, and that movie, like, technically passes the Bechdel test. Because there are two women talking to each other. But since they're talking about Mark Watney, I don't necessarily know if that counts.
Yeah, that talking about something other than a man.
But I always thought that that meant, like, romantically.
No, because it means that the man is driving the story still.
Yes. Well, yeah, he's definitely driving the story.
So this is
driving it to nowhere, the Mars rover. I actually really liked The Martian, the movie. Okay. I thought it fixed some of the things that I had problems with in the book. But it was definitely like MacGyver on Mars.
Yep.
So after a while, you're like, wow, you're really smart, Mark Watney. Good job.
This is why I don't think that... or I have had internal debates about whether Iron Man 3 passes the Bechdel-Wallace test or not. Because they do, there are these two female characters who are actually both really interesting characters, and they both have names and personalities, and they have this conversation with each other, and technically I believe the conversation is intended to be about their careers, but ultimately it winds up with both of them discussing Iron Man. And so I was sort of like, I don't really know if this counts or not.
Yeah, it's hard when Pepper Potts isn't, her career is, you know, is yeah. Iron Man. So,
yes.
Oh, my God. Age of Ultron would have ended in 5 minutes if they just fucking called Pepper Potts and been like, do your fire thing. Burn the robot. She'd be like,
okay.
Obliged. Here you go.
Ugh. Dumb.
God, I fucking hated Age of Ultron. I was reminded of its existence today. Someone on Twitter was like, I went looking for opinions about Age of Ultron, and I found, and he found my blog, and he agreed, and I was like, of course you agree, because you're a human being with eyes.
Two brain cells to rub together. And...
Ugh, seriously. Mm-mm-mm. So we're pushing the 27-minute mark. Is there anything else we want to talk about today?
One moment,
please.
You turned off your Wi-Fi.
I did turn off my Wi-Fi, even though my computer is plugged in. Vigilance, Bridget. Constant vigilance. Someone described Tumblr as gay porn roulette, and I was just like, accurate.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So we have a couple of questions today, and thank you everyone for bearing with us during our, and by our, I mean mine, because it was my fault that I didn't edit the query episode in anything resembling a timely fashion. But thank you for bearing with us. And...
I buy the wine. Jen edits the episodes. That's all her fault.
Yes. So we have a couple of questions. Anonymous says, Dear Bridget and Jen, do you have any self-editing tips? I'd like to give my revisions some extra kick. And while I have fantastic CPs, critique partners, mm-hmm. The first time I saw a CP in a sentence that was not, like, that was writing related, I thought I meant cerebral palsy, and
oh,
I was like,
no.
What the fuck?
You have multiple cerebral palsy.
I was just like, wow, that's a really intense situation you got going on there. But it means critique partners.
Yes.
I felt like a doofus after I figured that out.
This is, see, the writing world, I think about this sometimes, and, the friends I have who have either gotten married or gotten pregnant have sort of illuminated to me this world of strange and mysterious acronyms.
Like Dear Son or
yes!
Dear Daughter or something, or Darling Son or Darling Daughter.
Yeah.
Or something. I'm just like, ah, or DD, I'm like, Designated Driver. Okay,
so the writing world is sort of like, when you first venture into it, you're like, what is all this nonsense?
Okay, Dear Bridget and Jen, do you have any self-editing tips? I'd like to give my revision some extra kick. And while I have fantastic critique partners who read my works in progress more times than any reasonable human should, I want to try and fix as many things as I can before sending drafts to them. Any fave editing, writing, craft books you'd recommend? Sincerely, Cool Shades Anon. P.S. Y'all are great and should set up a PayPal button thing so we can donate to your wine fund. Hashtag cheers. Cheers
oh,
to you!
Cheers!
Cool Shades Anon. you know, there are a bunch of books out there. I think that one of the things recently that I heard that I thought was really interesting, and I don't know if this is just just too labor intensive for people, but I find that this is very true for me, is reading your draft out loud to someone.
Yeah.
Even just to yourself, because often when you read, your brain...
It's like, oh shit, the rhythm of that sentence
your
is
brain,
terrible.
Your brain fixes sentence like midway you're reading it out loud. That you might not notice otherwise.
Yeah.
And so I thought that, because I know I definitely do that with, like, when I'm reading things that people write to me, that I'm reading them out over the microphone, or when I'm reading a speech or something, I'm like, that sentence is dumb, I gotta change it. Your brain is much smarter sometimes than you give it credit.
And in a similar vein, sometimes just changing the font can kick something in your brain that will notice, that will notice errors.
Printing it out and doing it by hand.
Changing anything about the way that you're looking at it is incredibly helpful.
I change the way that I read manuscripts depending on what stage I am in edits.
Oh, yeah.
Because if it is, especially since I read some of my clients' manuscripts like 8 or 9 times before we go out on submission or before the book is published, you know, usually I do my first edits and my final edits on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything in between that is like with track changes and in Microsoft Word. But yeah, it helps to change anything about the way you're looking at your manuscript.
Personally, I find I think much more clearly about any manuscript I'm working on with a pencil in my hand.
Yes.
I don't even have to be writing anything down, though that helps. I often write out scene by scene, just like I take a piece of a notebook and write out each scene, a brief summary of each scene on one line. And then as the next, when the next scene comes up, I write that. And that can help you recognize patterns really easily.
Yeah.
I actually got that tip from Cheryl Klein, who is an editor at Scholastic. Her book, she has a new one coming out soon, but you can currently, I believe, get Second Sight, which is just a series of talks that she's given at various conferences and workshops sort of things.
Yeah.
And so that is an incredibly helpful book. She's really smart and is able to articulate these things in a really helpful way. So I highly recommend that.
Let me see if I can find this one thing that I thought was really interesting. So I can't find it right now, but somewhere on her Tumblr, Emily St. John Mandel, who wrote Station 11, had a little post about the various ways in which she revised Station 11.
Oh, that's helpful.
One of them was reading it out loud, and one of them was retyping it.
Oh, yeah. That was something that we were taught starting in like middle school when we were learning.
Never taught that.
Really?
Nope.
Well, it wasn't retyping it.
Texas
it was,
didn't give a shit.
I had multiple English teachers tell me this.
I got points taken off in seventh grade because my book reports weren't in color. So.
Oh no!
It was dark times. Like the time my mother had to go in and explain the ending of Macbeth to my teacher because she thought that Macbeth and Macduff don't fight.
Oh my god. This makes me sad because Texas basically dictates all of the textbooks for the entire United States.
You are telling me, sister. You are telling me.
Oh my god. Oh, our country is doomed. Anyway, so something that we were taught, or that I was taught.
In your fancy Connecticut schools.
My fancy Connecticut public schools. Was that if you is rewriting something from scratch. So you've written a draft, and you know what happens in it, and you know all of these things, and the beats, and the emotions, and the very, like, basic dialogue stuff that's going on. But then setting aside that draft and rewriting it from scratch, because your brain will just discard all of the stuff that you needed to flounder through in the first draft. And you've now figured that out, and it's not necessary anymore, and your brain will just hone it into the shape that you want it to be.
Yeah.
And you won't be relying on any of the crutches that you used in the last one.
Yeah.
So that can help.
Yeah. She also apparently shuffled all the pages and read it out of order.
Ha. That's not going to help you with the arcs, but it's going to help you with the line editing.
There was like a million things that she did that I was like, wow, you are hard fucking core.
Yeah.
But so I hope...
But also that book was really successful, so...
So, yeah. So I hope that one or all or some of those tips are helpful, and thank you very much for wanting to send us wine. That's very nice of
you. Also, I would like to say that, good on you for wanting to fix as many errors as possible before sending it to your CPs, because it's important to remember they will only read it fresh once.
Right.
And so then after that, they will be looking for the things that they noticed the first time. And they might notice additional things, but it'll still be in their brains the same way. So that's really good to try to revise as much as possible before sending it to them or before sending it to your agents.
Chin hands.
Yes.
Okay, next question. Another anonymous question. If you knew you were meeting an agent at an event where you'd have an opportunity to sit down with them, would it be weird/awkward to query them prior to the event?
Oh, yes. Don't do that.
Yes, that would be weird. I love you guys. I'm reading Fangirl right now and have never been happier. So
yay!
The reason that I wouldn't query someone beforehand is because you then lose the opportunity for that query to be interesting and
specific to them. And what if they reject you before they meet you? That's super awkward.
And especially like if you've scheduled pitch time, like at a conference.
Absolutely. Go meet them first. Talk to them about what they specifically want to see, and then tailor your query to that and say, it was so great to talk to you at this thing. I guarantee like 95% of the time you'll get a request out of that.
Yeah. Yes, what Bridget said. And also, I really hope you enjoy Fangirl because it is the best. I told you about the Carry On event, right? The Rainbow Rowell.
You sent me a couple of pictures from it, but you didn't tell me much.
It was wonderful. Rainbow Rowell and Rainbow Rowell had a launch party at Powerhouse Books in Brooklyn, and Lev Grossman did like a Q&A.
That's
and
so fun.
She's just so funny.
She is.
And I can't, you know, of course, because I was just sort of in this like... this happy haze. I don't really remember anything that she said, but she's just really funny and smart and said lots of really smart things. And I love her, and I'm very excited for Carrion. Yes.
You haven't read it yet?
I haven't, no. Well, I then had to go immediately to Sirens.
Ah.
And I thought that I should read.
You had to read a lot of other things at that time.
First. Okay, so I'll read out this question. Okay, the next question is from another user, Bisexual Shakespeare. Have you guys heard of Big Bang Press? It's an independent publisher working with fanfic writers. I'm all for fanfic writers getting credit for original work, but I don't know if having fans be the editors is a good idea. A fic can get away with shortcuts that I'm afraid won't be edited out. Are there mistakes you see in fanfic that you don't in submissions or vice versa? So yes, I do know about Big Bang Press. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting endeavor, and I know that one of the books is already out. I think it's called A Hero at the End of the World.
Okay.
And that author has actually found representation. She's represented by Juliet Mushins.
Oh, okay.
Which is like, you know, if you're going to be represented by anyone, you might as well be fucking represented by Juliet Mushins.
Yep. Well done.
You know, I don't think that it's necessary. I don't think that that fanfic writers being editors is a problem. And I think that the only issue that I see, you know, in crossing fan works over into sort of traditional works is fan fiction makes a lot of the shortcuts for you.
Yeah. You and don't have to. Well, this is actually something that I think can be a strength at times, where because fanfic writers are writing in a world that they expect their readers to understand, they don't spend any time explaining any of it. And I find that really satisfying as a reader, rather than having someone sit down and explain everything to me. I'm like, I'm going to figure this out. It will be fine.
But I think that when they cross over sometimes into non-fan works,
you don't spend the time to build the world.
They either don't spend the time to build the world, or they go too hard in the other direction and think the work isn't done. I have to double down. You know, I've represented several people who have either scraped the serial numbers or who have written fanfic in the past and are now working on original stuff. I think that fanfiction is wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And any endeavor that gets good writing into the hands of the public is good. You know, as far as Big Bang Press goes, like I'm really hoping that the next two books come out soon, because I think that if they're going to be a viable enterprise, which I'm sure they can be, then at a certain level, you just have to deliver the product.
Yeah.
And one of the benefits to traditional publishing is that there's an established timeline. You turn it, you sell the book, it's written before you sell it, and you got to publish it within 18 months or else it's a breach of contract.
There's actually a deadline in the contract.
As far as I understand, at least, I think the other two books aren't yet done or are in this process.
I don't know. I haven't been following it that much.
I'm not sure. I mean, and they're from writers that I love. So,
oh my god, yeah.
So I'm 100% excited to read it. So.
One of the people who founded this press wrote one of my favorite fan fictions ever.
Oh, so it's like the heavy hitters of like my favorite things ever. Yeah. So,
But yeah, the other thing I would stress is, you don't necessarily want to go with the first thing that's available to you.
Yes.
So if they have reached out to you or you've sent something to them and they're interested in publishing it, that's wonderful.
I don't think that they're open to submissions, though.
Oh, okay.
Because I think that they're just starting with those three.
Okay.
With those three authors that
the ones that are founding.
They're seeing how that goes, I think. And then
if they do reach out to you, the thing that I would recommend is keeping your other options open. If you've written something that can stand on its own, hopefully someone else will be interested in that as well.
Yeah.
So look widely.
I think that one of the things that I see now, which I find very interesting, is that there is a sense, and you know, I haven't really been very involved in fanfic spaces lately, so it's entirely true that I'm sort of overgeneralizing, but with the people that I follow, the sort of even the sort of like proto BNF types that I follow, there's this sense that, you know, publishing isn't looking for anything interesting, which I think is A, not true, and B, creates this sort of environment of like self-defeating.
Yeah, where like if you don't give it to us, we can't publish it.
Yes,
and I would love to see it.
Yes, exactly. So yeah. So that's sort of our feelings on that. So next question, another anonymous asks, what makes an ideal client for you? I'm newly agented, currently working on revisions.
Have we answered this question before?
No. What makes an ideal client for you? I'm newly agented, currently working on revisions, and this is all new to me. I would love some kind of guidance on how agents ideally want to work with their clients. On the flip side, and just for funsies, what's your idea of the client from hell? I've listened to all your apps multiple times, by the way. That's my way of saying I love the podcast and also passive-aggressively encouraging you to record more often. Great show. Thanks, Brenda and Judden. You know, end tag lol jokes. I mean, for me, an ideal client is one where we have good lines of communication,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's expectations are understood from the beginning.
Yes.
That is my ideal. Because any other way, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah. I love someone who is resilient because things go wrong in publishing, and someone who was able to say, okay, that sucks. Let's do the next thing.
Publishing is Mars. You are Mark Watney, and you will die if you don't grow potatoes. I am not even kidding.
So, yes. So that's something I value very highly. I have been fortunate enough to be blessed with several of those clients, and I am incredibly pleased to be working with them. But also someone who values my expertise and wants to hear what I have to say, but also like has a sense of their own worth and their own ideas and isn't just going to blindly follow my suggestions. Someone who is going to say, I hear what you're saying. I think it has value. Here's what I want to do about it. That is pretty much perfect. And especially in terms of revising. That's
yes.
That's the kind of thing
I don't
look
like
for.
Hearing that in submissions.
No.
I know you want to send to this editor that you know and love.
Yes.
And that you know would be perfect for my book. But I read on the internet that this other editor would be perfect. Ah,
yes. Yeah. There are some
that
things
that has not happened to me, but I've heard about it happening to other people. I just cannot even imagine having my submissions not permitted that way.
What I want is respect for my professional expertise. And respect for your own craft. I signed you for a reason. I think you're a talented writer. I want to know what you have to say about that. But also, I assume you signed with me for a reason. And so I want you to respect what I have to say about the things that agents do.
Yes. Okay. Do you guys tip each other on queries you pass on, but the other one might like? That hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened yet. Very occasionally. Usually, I'm more likely to pass something along to my boss just because she's in the room next to me.
Yeah, I'm more likely to send things to people in the agency. The only exception to that is I don't know that anyone at the DMLA does middle grade, and Bridget does middle grade. So
yes, I do.
If I saw a middle grade that I thought, hey,
maybe this isn't terrible.
Okay, so next question. When I started writing, I heard from a writing podcast that you should only use said even after a question mark, as in, how long will it be, Jen said. Now in workshops, people tell me that I should go for how long will it be, Jen asked, which is right.
Asked.
Wow. This is
incredibly so specific. But no, asked and said are sort of similar in that they're non-entities.
Where you don't want to go is like Jen opined,
or yes.
Jen lamented, or Jen cried.
Very occasionally you can use dialogue tags that actually indicate an emotion, but for the most part you don't want to. You just want people to read the dialogue and know who said it, so that they can sort of visualize the exchange in their head. And asked is equally as invisible as said.
Yes.
But you also don't want asked. In like a conversation.
Yes.
Generally my advice is to make dialogue tags as invisible as possible.
Yes. Next question. First off, I love your podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so my question is, once we finish a manuscript but before sending out queries for it, how important is it to have it professionally edited, i.e. paying a pro and not just passing it on to friends and family? Is it not necessarily highly suggested or absolutely required? And if so, what kind of editing is recommended and how much money should be realistically spent on it?
That's not necessary. Don't do it. It's basically, if you are running into a wall with querying and lots of people are requesting your manuscript, but no one is really latching onto it, maybe at that point. But for the most part, I do not encourage people to spend any money before getting an agent.
Yes.
You can, and like also then don't necessarily spend money once you have the agent.
I mean, the places where I find if you're gonna spend money on something, you know, things like workshops might be more useful depending on the workshop, depending on the people that are going to be there.
Absolutely.
You know, places where you can get collaborative feedback and hear other people's work, because I think that the other thing is it's very important to see other people growing at the same time that you grow. But like Bridget said, you know, independent editing has a lot of really great uses, but I don't necessarily think that it's before the querying prospect.
No.
Because, I mean, we've both signed things with, like, massive typos in it.
Oh, yeah.
We've signed things with, like, questionable grammar.
Signed things that needed basically entire rewrites, but I just knew how to do it.
You know, we can see a way through, and we like it so much that we want to spend that time.
Yeah.
And I feel like that way... Because hopefully your primary creative relationship is going to be with your agent.
Yes.
And with, you know, your eventual editors. And I feel like bringing in independent editors at the agenting stage makes that relationship more central. Yes.
It also prevents me from seeing what your...
Unfiltered.
Writing.
Not unfiltered.
Like, the way that you create a story without outside influence. Unless you're planning to hire this editor for every book you write, that's not terribly helpful for me. I was going to say something.
I mean, I think the one area where I would say an independent editor is absolutely required is if you are planning on self-publishing.
Yes. Oh my God, yes. Then hire someone.
If you are going to self-publish and you're going to do it right, you have to hire an editor.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only is that editor going to hopefully make your book make sense, but hopefully that editor will be available to copy edit it.
Yes.
Once it is ready to go. Because, you know, where if you send it to an agent, they're going to be more forgiving of typos and, you know, sort of nonsensical side plots. But if you self-publish something, you know, no one's going to buy your book.
Something
if it's not up to par.
Yeah. Something else to be aware of, though, is that developmental edits and copy edits are very different skills, and not everyone has both of them.
Yes. Yes, that is true.
So do keep that in mind. Oh, damn it. It was there and it left. Oh, the other thing I was going to say is if at least one of your CPs is not someone that you look at and say, this person is such a good writer, I will never be as good as them, you need to find more CPs. Yes. You should have at least someone in your group who you admire immensely.
Who is farther along in the process.
Yes, and who you think is just a fantastic writer. Writing and editing are very different skills, and not everyone has both of them. I am not a novelist, and so that is not necessarily a skill I have. But you want to have someone who is going to push you to be better, who is not just going to say, oh, yeah, this is great. I could never write this book.
And sometimes I know, and also, you know, if you do decide, if you do, against our advice, decide that this is the route you want to go, if all the advice you get back from the editor is, like, super positive, then that was not money well spent.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that's just sort of, like, yesing.
Yeah.
I don't know any book that sort of sprang fully formed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Am I just being reductive?
No, that makes sense. Okay. And also something you should do, and that most legitimate freelance editors are willing to do, is a test edit, where you send them a certain number of pages and they will edit it for free to see if you're a good match.
And most good independent editors also provide a list of references.
Mm-hmm.
So people you can reach out to, be like, you know, on this person's website it says that you worked with them on an independent edit.
What do you think?
What do you feel? You know, how did you feel? Well, I think that's the end of our questions. Let me just double check Twitter real quick. Actually, I think we might have a couple on Gmail.
Oh.
Because it's been so long. Okay. So we have a question via email from Roslyn. Question for you. Shouts out to my client, Mer Lafferty, for suggesting this podcast in one of her I Should Be Writing episodes.
Thanks, Mer.
A question for you.
I have never met Mer. Is she coming to World Fantasy?
No, I don't think she is, because it's a little bit. Because she went to WorldCon, and then she also went somewhere else. Question for you. When seeking out agencies / agents of the novel, is it improper decorum to send a query letter to every agent in an agency that represents the genre of a proposed novel? Or does that come across as an act of desperation to agents and leads to a request getting canned? Disclaimer, I have not done this and want to avoid doing so if it's frowned upon.
Yeah, usually don't do that. Usually agencies will say on their website whether they accept queries separately or altogether, or if you should only query one. In general, I advise querying only one at a time. Sometimes you can then subsequently query others. At my agency, we only have one query inbox, and I read all of them first. So if you query both me and my boss, I'm like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this?
Because then it becomes, we don't want to compete against each other.
Yeah, that's sort of what it is. But the other thing is that often if we think something is good but not for us, we will pass it to other people. I have actually done this, and my boss subsequently signed a client because I said, this book is good, but I don't like it very much. And I gave it to my boss, and she's like, oh, you're right. It is exactly my sense of humor. And I was like, ah, there we go. I knew it was good. and so it's, keep that in mind that we will sometimes pass them between each other. And so query one, try to pick the one that's closest to what you do. And then if they decide it's not for them, if the agency allows it, you can query someone else at the agency.
And, my client, Ann Kopchick, like 6 years ago, queried Jennifer Jackson.
Hey.
Jennifer Jackson passed.
I think after 6 years, you're allowed to,
Well, I signed her like 3 years ago, but, okay, so I think that that's actually all the time we have for questions. We have two more in the email that that we're going to get to next time, but okay. It is now the 56-minute mark, so...
I think we're going
to
cut at least 6 minutes of that, but yes.
But still, that's a 50-minute episode, so yes. We want to keep it.
Let's move on.
Sure. So, Bridget, what are you reading these days?
Well,
I... Is the answer nothing? Or is the answer Tamara Pierce?
The answer is Tamara Pierce. I'm reading the Becca Cooper books, which are very different... And very long. I know
weren't
that...
Weren't you reading those last time?
No. Definitely
or
not.
Or you were about to start them.
That was, I think, our next batch. Yeah. But yes, no, she talks a lot about how grateful she is to Harry Potter and Twilight for allowing her to write longer books. But these books are 600 pages long, and they definitely do not need to be that long. And it's driving me crazy. They take forever to read. And also it's things like, I ran errands and bought this stuff. And I'm like, that was... a really unnecessary scene. If you had to keep this to 300 pages, you would have cut that scene. I'm also about to start Six of Crows tonight, which I'm very excited about.
I have not started reading it yet.
No, I haven't either. but Leigh Bardugo is coming to New York this Friday for the Fierce Reads tour.
And I'm going to be out of town.
Terrible. How dare you?
I'm actually really upset because... I really want to meet Emma Mills, and yes! I'm super pissed.
She is also on the Fierce Reads tour.
Her book came out yesterday.
Yay! I'm very excited.
First in that, available now at a retailer near you.
Oh, people seem to like it, which is good.
Humble brag.
Yes. Not even humble, I'm just really pleased.
I am the opposite of humble.
So, my client is coming to town on tour on Friday, and so I need to read the other books that by the author she's on tour with. And I read Tonight the Streets Are Ours already, and I need to read Six of Crows, or at least get far enough into it that I have an opinion.
That book is so metal. If you have not seen the hardcover, do you have the hardcover?
No, I have the ARC.
Oh, okay, so the hardcover, which I bought, is it's hardcover. It's got like a black, you know, cool cover.
Yeah.
And the edges are black.
Oh,
the edges of the
awesome.
Pages are black. It's the most metal book ever. I was like, this makes me so happy. I don't even know what the book's about. I'm just like,
just awesome. I honestly, I'm like 75% sure they chose the books that they were, or the authors they were sending on tour by which covers look good together, because Six of Crows is black and gray. First and Then is rainbow on white. And then Tonight the Streets Are Ours and Firewalker by Josephine Angelini are both sort of shades of purple and red. And like these, this is basically, these covers all look great together.
Nice.
And I mean, that's not the worst way to choose a tour.
And they're like the 92nd Street Y, right?
Yeah. Oh,
fancy.
I'm so excited about it. I'm very sorry we can't record an episode with Emma.
I know. Well, she'll just have to come back.
Yes, it's true. She likes New York, though, so she comes sometimes.
Yeah, if
so
she ever
next
wants to
time
come
she's
back,
come here.
You know, tell her I got the Hamilton ticket hookup.
Oh.
Actually, I don't have the hookup. It's like, yeah. It's just it's just a way of paying $165 for house seats.
I was like, Jen, can you help me out with this?
Oh my god. I emailed my friend today and I was like, so my parents are coming in November. She was like, this adorable note. I was like, I mean, I knew it was going to be no, but yeah, I feel like I should say before I start talking about what I've been reading that I have been obsessively listening to the soundtrack or the original Broadway cast recording of Broadway's Hamilton, which, if you are like a human being with ears who likes either hip hop or musicals, you should buy and listen to because it's amazing.
See, I would really like to see this show, and I know that listening to the recording is going to be a diluted version of it.
It's actually not, because it's the whole show.
Oh.
Because it's a sung through musical.
Oh, wow.
There's actually only one scene in the entire show that is not included, and it's like a minute long and doesn't actually affect the plot.
Huh.
But it's a sung through show, but it has sort of reignited my desire to learn more about, like, American history.
So instead of World War II. World War One,
Bridget.
I'm sorry.
One.
I always get them mixed up. I've done this before. It's What's terribly embarrassing.
No, but anyway, so it's really fabulous. And I think it actually might still be up on NPR to listen to for free. But it's wonderful and lyrically dense and nuanced and fabulous.
And everyone on my Twitter feed is listening to it.
Because they're right about many things.
I have good taste in people.
Yes, you do. What else have I read recently? So I mentioned earlier that I'd finished up the Ray Carson trilogy. Had I talked about... So I have actually been doing a lot of reading recently, and I can't remember when... Oh, I had... So I finished reading the fifth season, and I have to talk about fifth season for a minute.
Oh, I really want to read it.
Oh my god, it's so good.
I own it, and I bought it at her launch party, which was great.
No, I remember. We talked about it in the last episode.
Yeah. Yeah, and I it's still sitting on my pile, and I'm like, I'm going to read this next, except after Six of Crows, and then after this other thing.
No, you should read it after Six of Crows, because it is so good. And one of the things that I love about it is I did not see the end coming.
Oh.
And I can almost always see the end coming.
Yeah.
And her writing is beautiful.
Yeah.
The world building is fabulous. So it's this world that's very sort of tectonically active, you know? And so the
magic...
It
was cool. She had little candies shaped like rocks and like painted like rocks at the launch party. It was really cool. And she had a little volcano thing.
So me and Sunil Patel had this whole thing at Worldcon where... I had told him that I'd bought it because I bought it at WorldCon, and he's like, "Oh my god, have you read it?" I was like, "No, Sunil, I just bought it." And so then when I was tweeting about it, when I finished it, it was basically just like all caps shouting about how much I loved it, and he was like, "Oh my god, have you gotten to the end?" And then we just had this like 40 tweet like all caps like freak out at each other,
awesome
about how much we loved it.
Oh, that's the
best. I mean, it's some of the most original world building and some of the great. The magic is really original, and like all the characters are wonderful, and I like all the relationships are really interesting.
Oh, nice!
And the politics are really interesting, and like the stakes are just like fascinating, and oh my god, it's. I finished it, and then I think, like, 3 days later, she's like, I handed in the manuscript, and I was like, fuck, I have to wait so long.
It's like another year.
Oh, seriously, so long. So I read that. I've literally been doing a lot of reading, but I read The Water Knife by Paolo Bacigalupi.
I believe it's Bacigalupi.
Bacigalupi? It's so good.
Nice.
It made good me feel really bad about every time I've, like, brushed my teeth and left the water running a little too long. I read some romance that I really
See, this
liked.
Is a huge problem because our kitchen sink and our shower take like 5 minutes to actually get warm. So you have to run it for 5 minutes with cold water just gushing through before you are actually able to get into the shower or wash your dishes.
Take cold shower, Bridget. Showers.
But
I don't
it's
know
so
why
unpleasant.
I take cold shower. I'm so tired. So anyway, I'm just moving right along. I feel like I could talk about what I've been reading for, like, 9 years, but...
Because it's been 6 weeks since we recorded?
Well, yes. I read, Linda Aker has two books. She's a romance, like, erotica writer. She's fabulous. Published by Carina. I finished Castles of Steel, which was great.
Nice.
Although, I think Dreadnought was better. Okay. Because once you get into naval battles, it's like, this ship went this way, and this other ship went this way, and you have to remember which ship is German and which ship isn't. And I'm like, I can't. I'm sorry.
Don't the German ones have pretty German names?
Not always! Because remember, Kaiser Bill was Queen Victoria's grandson.
Oh, right.
So, the other three books that I want to talk about very quickly, because we're running so out of time.
Yes.
But, I read this book called The Odd Woman in the City.
Mm-hmm. I like the title.
It's basically this woman, Vivian Gornick, who's written a bunch of nonfiction books, and I think a couple novels as well, just talking about walking around New York City, and it's fabulous. Oh. It's really short.
Nice.
But I also read Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson, which was amazing. I was not expecting it to be great because I bounced off the Baroque trilogy, the Baroque whatever, so hard.
I did not get more than one page into Anathem.
I have Anathem, and I have not started reading it.
I got as far as the epigram, which includes three other invented words in order to define the word anathem. And I was like, nope.
See, I love that shit.
like, I could not roll my eyes at this harder. Give me that Borgesian
nonsense, please. But Seven Eves is really amazing. And it's basically, the first like half of it is sort of like The Martian, where they're like, this is the problem and we must solve it.
Mm.
But it's also all about sort of these people realizing that humanity is dying and they're the only people left that are going to like... Okay. It's so good. And it's all about women and like really feminist in this very strange way. And like, you know, it's these women who have to work together to sort of preserve the human race.
Oh,
and it's,
nice.
Oh, it's so good.
Girls who have each other's backs.
Kind of. Kind of. I mean, yes, but also no. Also very much no.
Okay. Well, see, that just makes it interesting.
Yes. But I think my favorite thing that I've read in the last 6 weeks is Wolf in White Van by John Darnielle.
Okay.
Which is a novel about a guy who has suffered some sort of unspecified accident. He calls it an accident.
Mm.
But you sort of feel like it's not an accident. Who sort of is a, you know, home buddy who runs this sort of write-in role-playing game. So you write in and you get a move. And he has been held responsible for the deaths of two teens who are playing this game. And so it's about him sort of, like, dealing with what happened, both with them and with himself. And it's, I mean, it's one of those beautifully written books I think I've read all year. Like, the, just line by line is just beautiful. And the book is, like, heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So it's only 200 pages. You should definitely read it. I think it was, like, a National Book Award finalist or something. Oh, yeah. Like,
I've had so many recommendations.
And I was sort of like, you know, he's a great lyricist. Like, is the book good? It's good. It's so good. So. Good, okay, well, that's my, like, 10 minutes of talking about what I've written.
Yes.
I'm currently reading this book, The Invention of Murder, by Judith Flanders, which is so up my alley.
That sounds so interesting.
It's incredibly interesting. It's about how the Victorians reveled in death and detection and created modern crime. I literally wrote my thesis about this.
The Victorians are both insane and also, like, very much my kind of people.
Yes. My favorite thing, and I actually sent this in a message to someone earlier, that one of the early sort of murders in the 19th century was this guy who murdered someone and then he hung, but there was so much press attention
hanged
around...
Hanged. It's not laundry.
Damn. Okay, so then he hanged. Damn.
This is my discreet thing.
Okay, that's fair. I actually genuinely don't know the difference. So this guy hanged by the neck until dead. But there was so much press attention around his case that there was all these, like, weird, like, press for, like, relics. So they literally, like, wrote an account of the trial and then, like, took his skin and bound the book in it.
Oh, awesome.
And it's at a museum that our friend is in London and she needs to go see.
There are multiple books at my alma mater that are bound in human skin.
Well, aren't you metal? Good Lord. Yes. Anyway, so this book is really enjoyable and I'm reading that right now.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah. And on that note, since we are an hour and 10 minutes into the recording,
let's kill this episode.
Let's kill this. Whoa. Thank you so much for listening again.
Yes, thank you. And for not minding our murder puns.
Mind the murder. Oh, God. You can send us your questions to @shipandhandling or via our Ask Box on Tumblr or to shippingandhandlingpodcast@gmail.com. So those two folks who have sent in questions in the last 6 weeks, you probably know who you are.
Yes.
We're going to get to you next week. I apologize for the delay.
We will answer your questions, I promise.
Yes. And that is it. And thank you again. And happy reading. Bye.